This went higher than the Swiss banker. Someone had gotten to his security team and given instructions that Obrecht was not to fall into the hands of the CIA. It had been a mistake to send Gould. She'd underestimated his mental instability, as she had Rickman's. Now was not the time to start questioning her own judgment, but she could feel doubt creeping in. How could it not? Again, Nash seemed to be able to hear her thoughts. "Sometimes you just have to roll the dice, Irene. Mitch agreed with you that this was our best shot to get Obrecht and shut down Rickman's machine. We all did." She leaned back in her chair and tried to work through what was happening. Obrecht would never talk, but at least his death provided confirmation that someone was pulling his strings. Someone very well informed and very well funded. Once again, she came back to Pakistan and the ISI. The simple answer was that it was one of Durrani's deputies covering his tracks. But with a new operations director in place, would anyone in the S-Wing have sufficient support to pull off something like this? The answer was as clear as it was terrifying. Not without Ahmed Taj's blessing. "Has there been any progress on the lawyer angle?" she asked. There was no hard evidence that Rickman would use a law firm to release the information he possessed. But the more she considered it, the more the theory made sense. Terrorists and criminals could be useful, but reliability wasn't one of their more prominent qualities. No, if you needed something done confidentially and efficiently, a lawyer was the most straightforward solution. "Nothing yet," Nash said. "Marcus is working with the NSA on it. Their ability to crunch data is almost unlimited now that they have Daisy Chain up and running at their Utah facility. If anything unusual happens at a law firm anywhere in the world, and anyone so much as tweets about it, we'll know." Daisy Chain was a quiet, though in this case entirely legal, system that scoured the Internet 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It catalogued every news organization website, online magazine, blog, and government site worldwide. Then it translated the pages into English and used artificial intelligence to analyze the information based on whatever search parameters were put into the system. She'd authorized soliciting the NSA's help, but wasn't particularly happy about their involvement. They had an incredible infrastructure in place for this kind of investigation, but the organization had been too much in the spotlight lately. The kind of technology they used was just coming into its own, and they were a bit like a toddler with a new toy, if that toy was a chainsaw. "Then it's a waiting game," she said. "We sit here until another one of Rick's videos is released, and another one of our operatives is compromised or killed." Nash nodded. "For now, I'm afraid so." Chapter 35. Near Chania, Greece. The tiny rental car was struggling with the grade, forcing Rapp to keep one eye on the engine's temperature gauge. When it finally touched red, he parked at the edge of the empty dirt road. There was no wind at all when he stepped out, only the heat of the Greek sun on his back and the vague scent of chemical explosives still clinging to his hair. The yellow grass that covered the hill glowed in the light, making the deep green of scattered olive trees seem almost black. Far below, he could see the city and the ocean beyond. Many people considered it paradise, and on that particular day it was hard to argue. He continued on foot, retrieving a cigarette from the pack in his pocket. He raised a lighter to it, but then noticed an unusual sound in the still air around him. His own breathing. Rapp stopped, squinted up at the winding road, and then down at the cigarette. The grade was no steeper than 15%, and his elevation above sea level was low enough that he could pick out individual sailboats below. 2 years ago, he'd led a 30-mile trail-running race through the Colorado Mountains, finally turning off a half-mile before the finish line in order to avoid the cameras set up to capture the winner. He wouldn't have to worry about anyone snapping his picture or asking for an interview now. Full gas, he'd be lucky to break the top five in a race like that. Rapp looked out over the ocean, his thoughts turning again to Stan Hurley. In many ways, he'd been a great man, brave, loyal, patriotic. One of the only people Rapp had ever met who he never even considered worrying about. There was nothing the world could throw at Stan that could knock him off target. Having said that, it would be a mistake to romanticize him. He'd left 3 ex-wives, and only 2 of his 5 children would take his calls. He lived his life at the very edge of control, with little concern for himself or those around him. He was probably the best friend Rapp ever had, but also self-destructive, violent, and, as Anna had pointed out on numerous occasions, a bad influence. Rapp's love-hate relationship with the old man had started out more hate-hate. He could still remember saying that he'd put a gun in his mouth if he ever found himself turning into Stan Hurley. Yet there he was, living alone in a crap apartment near D.C., smoking and drinking too much in an effort to mask the rage lurking just below the surface, and breathing audibly, walking up a hill that he should have been able to do at a full sprint. The old man was dead. Anna was dead. Gould was dead. His past felt like it had been suddenly stripped away. The question was what he was going to do about it. Would he allow himself to become even more disconnected? To lose even more of who he was? Or would he hit the reset button? At 44, there could be a lot of years left. Rapp wadded up the pack and threw it into the trees before starting up the road again. Strangely, his breathing didn't sound quite as loud. Even with Hurley's death, the inevitable blowback from the Obrecht op and the impending release of the next Rickman file, he felt a little lighter. Might as well enjoy the illusion while it lasted. When the farmhouse came into view, he slowed, assuming that there was at least one set of crosshairs tracking his head. The building was constructed from stone and white stucco, with blue window frames and a cheerful red roof. It was isolated and easy to protect, but close enough to a tourist town that foreigners went unnoticed. The landscaping was mostly natural and littered with toys. Everything from a pink big wheel to a dollhouse faded by the sun. A man appeared on the north side of the house, walking purposefully but keeping a tree between him and his unannounced guest. His plaid shorts, T-shirt, and straw hat looked right at home in the resort area. The expected flip-flops were the only thing missing, replaced by a pair of shoes built for stability and speed. A long-sleeved shirt that hid the veins mapped across his biceps and forearms would have been preferable, but it was a minor oversight. Hurley had found him in Afghanistan, attached to the Green Berets. Rapp recalled that he was an unusually smart kid with a sense of determination that made up for unspectacular natural athletic ability. Bob something. No. Ben. Ben Carter. "Hello?" the man called out. His hand was nowhere near the gun he undoubtedly had holstered in the small of his back. But he looked scared. In fact, he looked terrified. Confused, Rapp started reaching subtly for his own weapon, but then stopped when he recognized the problem. Carter had become fond of the woman and child he'd been charged with protecting. "That's not why I'm here, Ben." The former soldier let out an audible breath. "I'm sorry, Mr. Rapp. No one called ahead to tell us you were coming. Is she inside?" "Yes, sir. With her daughter." Rapp went up the gravel walkway, stepping over a sandy boogie board and knocking on the door. The woman who opened it was as beautiful as he remembered. At 36, her round face was still smooth and dominated by bright, almond-shaped eyes. Her dark hair was a little longer now, and the smile was something he'd never seen. It quickly faded into the deep sadness he recalled from last time, when he'd had a gun pressed to the side of her head. "Are you here to kill me?" Claudia Gould said in accented English. His reputation was well deserved, but sometimes he wished it didn't follow him so closely. "No." "You're here to tell me something about Louis?" "Yes." Her eyes closed for a moment, and he could see that she was concentrating on not crying. When they opened again, she stepped aside to let him enter. "Can I get you something?" she said, speaking on autopilot. "No, thank you." She was wearing a 2-piece swimsuit with a sheer sarong tied around her hips. Rapp didn't allow his eyes to linger. "Tell me," she said. The last time he'd visited her home, he'd spared her husband's life. It had been obvious even then that it was a serious tactical error, but he didn't regret it. It happened at a time in his life when he'd needed to regain some of his humanity. "He's dead, isn't he?" Rapp nodded. Claudia switched to her native French. "Did you kill him?" "No." Her eyes turned misty, but still there were no tears. Maybe she understood that she was better off, or maybe she was just tired of crying over the man.
"After what happened to your wife," she said, "after you spared us, I thought it was enough to make him see clearly. I was stupid to believe that he'd quit. I let myself be blinded."
"It's not your fault, Claudia. He had everything. It just wasn't enough."
"Was it?" Her voice faltered. "Was it quick?"
"He never knew what hit him," Rapp lied. There was no reason to make her suffer any more than she already had.
"Bonjour."
Rapp turned and managed a smile at the sight of a girl skidding to a stop on bare feet. She was 7 now, with disheveled, sun-bleached hair and a swimsuit similar to her mother's. The sunscreen on her face hadn't been completely rubbed in, leaving a white streak across her nose that smelled like coconuts.
"Bonjour,"
Rapp said. Claudia had named the girl after his wife, and he found it hard to say aloud.
"You must be Anna."
"That's right. Who are you?"
"My name's Mitch. I'm an old friend of your mother's. You and I met once, too, but you were just a baby."
"I don't remember stuff from when I was a baby."
"Me neither."
"Are you coming with us to the beach? You're not dressed."
"I don't think so. I just need to talk to your mom for a couple of minutes."
"I'm going to see if Ben wants to make castles. He's really good at it. He can even make the things that look like teeth on top of the walls."
"Merlins."
"What?"
"The teeth are called merlins, and the gaps between them are called crenels."
"Are you making that up? How do you know that?"
The sad truth was that it was because he was an encyclopedia with only one chapter, Things That Could Be Used for War. "I saw a TV show on it once."
"I'm going to ask if Ben knows that."
Rapp watched her run out before turning back to Claudia.
"Beautiful girl."
"I don't deserve her."
She motioned around the house that Irene Kennedy was paying for.
"Or this."
"Everyone makes mistakes. What matters is that we try to make up for them."
He dug an iPhone out of his pocket and handed it to her. The display had a screenshot of a mutual fund statement. "We consolidated all of Louis's accounts into this one. It's all clean, and the taxes have been paid. You don't have anything to worry about." Her eyes widened.
"There's almost $30 million here."
Rapp nodded. "The account is under the name Claudia Dufour. We're working with the French government to get you a new passport, a legend, and everything else you'll need to stay off Louis's enemy's radar. Irene got you permanent residence in South Africa, and she used some of your money to buy you a house in the wine country. I think Anna will like it. There's a good school close by and plenty of space for a horse or two."
The tears finally came.
She threw her arms around him and began to sob.
"I'm so sorry, Mitch. I'm so sorry for everything I've done to you."
Chapter 36. CIA Headquarters, Langley, Virginia, USA. Irene Kennedy pushed her reading glasses onto her forehead, trying to chase the image of Stan Hurley from her mind. There would be time to mourn him later. Right now, her only responsibility was to ensure that no more of her people ended up like him. The handwritten list on the desk in front of her had been pulled almost entirely from her impeccable memory. It looked as innocuous as a guest list to one of her son's birthday parties, but in fact, it was the most sensitive catalog of names ever put to paper. It included every significant spy or informant currently controlled by the CIA, from the Middle East to China to Europe. Even South America and Australia were represented. 3 numbers accompanied each name. The first ranked the likelihood that Rickman would be aware of that individual's existence on a scale of 1 to 10. The second used an inverse scale to rank each operative's importance to America's security. Finally, the third number was the sum of the first two. The 20s, people who were low-level and unquestionably known by Rickman, were already being prepared for extraction. Too much risk for not enough reward. The 2s, critical personnel that Rickman would likely be unaware of, would be staying where they were. The question was, how far down did she go with extractions? 15s? 10s? How many lives would she jeopardize in the interest of America's intelligence efforts? Once again, Hurley intruded on her thoughts, this time whispering in her ear, "You took this job, Princess. Suck it up and do it." There was a knock on the door, and Mike Nash poked his head in. "Bad time?" She flipped the list face down on her desk. "A welcome interruption. Are you bringing me good news?" He entered but didn't respond to her question. "I'll take anything at this point, Mike." "Coffee machine's fixed." Kennedy smiled. She still wasn't sure about Nash, but her view of the man was evolving. She'd been doing some detailed research into his background and discovered that he'd always been the charismatic charmer. Voted most popular in high school, class president in college, and the beneficiary of almost fanatical loyalty from the Marines he'd led in combat. It was a gift that few people had, and one that couldn't be taught. Kennedy had many competent people working for her, but their personalities often left a bit to be desired, mostly insufferable wonks, slick politicians, and swaggering cowboys. Then there was Mitch, who wasn't exactly a favorite on Capitol Hill. At best, he elicited nervousness from Congress. At worst, fear and hatred. Kennedy didn't exempt herself from her clear-eyed evaluation. She was largely seen as an icy intellectual alone in a sea of people who made decisions based on their gut instead of their head. It was a trait that made people question whether there was anything she really believed in. The answer was that there was. She believed in getting the job done. Nash could be a bit of a hand-wringer, but admittedly an extremely intelligent one. He'd performed well since Rapp had forced him out of the field and behind a desk. He was good at handling the overblown egos on the Hill, and a near prodigy at motivating people. While she and Nash were very different, who was to say that her approach was right and his was wrong? As her mentor, Thomas Stansfield, had been fond of saying, there was more than one way to skin a cat. "Unfortunately, I'm a tea drinker," Kennedy said. "Where are we on finding the people disseminating the Rickman files?" "Let's just say we're moving generally forward," he said, sitting in one of the chairs lined up in front of her desk. "Everyone agrees with your idea that he'd go to an attorney, but the category, every ambulance chaser on the planet, is a pretty big one." "Is the NSA producing?" "That's the problem. Their AI's ability to filter out the junk is less impressive than they let on. We're getting everything from a bunch of lawyers in D.C. who won an intramural softball game to a London firm that signed on to represent J.K. Rowling in a plagiarism suit."
"Nothing useful, then."
"We thought we had something with a break-in at a firm in Buenos Aires, but it turned out to be a drug addict who got caught 2 days later pawning their laptops. We have people working around the clock, sifting through all the hits. Anything that looks even vaguely interesting gets sent to me."
"What about Marcus?"
"He's working on the next step under the assumption that the NSA will eventually turn up something we can use. He figures that the files are being released by some kind of hacker, someone crooked enough to be willing to decrypt and send out classified material, but smart enough to keep it from being traced back to him. Finding a guy like that should be right in Marcus's wheelhouse."
Kennedy took a sip of her tea, not sure how much to say.
It was in her nature to keep secrets, but if things went as badly as she expected, Nash would need to be aware of her suspicions.
"We have even less time than you might imagine, Mike. I believe that we're not just in a race against Rick, but that we're competing with another organization."
Nash nodded. "The Pakistanis." She was pleased that he'd come to the conclusion on his own.
"Please, go on."
"It's hard to believe that Akhtar Durrani was the only person in the S-Wing who knew about Rick's files. And if they're aware they exist, they want them something awful. Depending on how much Rick knew, The ISI could co-opt our entire network in the Middle East. Maybe worldwide.
But who? Kennedy prompted.
One of Durrani's men? If you work for the ISI, getting hold of the CIA's throat wouldn't exactly be bad for your career. It was a reasonable hypothesis, maybe even the right one. But she was concerned Nash was thinking too small.
What about President Chutani?
Nash's expression turned thoughtful. There's no question that Chutani would like to take a peek at Rick's files and hold some of them over us, but I'm not sure he has that kind of penetration into the S-Wing yet.
I tend to agree. Have you considered Ahmed Taj?
Yeah, he's a lot more interesting.
How so? Kennedy said, wondering if Nash recognized he was being tested and just wasn't letting on.
She hoped that was the case.
I've met the guy a couple times, and I've read all the files we've got on him. Everything points to him being weak. I'm starting to wonder, though, Durrani's death would have created quite a power vacuum at the ISI. We should have seen a lot of fireworks, but we didn't. I've seen successions in my kid's Boy Scout troop go harder than that.
Kennedy remained silent, taking another sip of her tea.
So do you think I'm totally off base here, Irene? Maybe Chutani's got a better handle on the ISI than I'm giving him credit for.
No. Unfortunately, I find myself nursing the same suspicions. Our analysts have been telling me for years that Taj is too feeble to control the ISI, and in the same breath, they tell me that the ISI is becoming increasingly effective. Somewhere there's a disconnect between theory and reality. If you discard the conventional wisdom that Taj is just a figurehead, it's amazing how quickly the picture comes into focus.
I hope you're wrong, Nash said, because I'd rather see those files in the hands of Al-Qaeda than the ISI. Before she could respond, an alarm sounded on her laptop. She felt her heart rate accelerate. That particular chime was set to sound only when an email arrived from Joe Rickman.
Rick? Nash said, noticing her sudden pallor.
She nodded and opened her inbox as he moved to a position where he could look over her shoulder. The attachment was another video. Kennedy felt her mouth go dry when she started the playback.
Hello, Irene. I'd say it's good to see you, but I can't see you because you had me killed.
He was sitting with his boots on the desk again, wearing the same clothes he had in the last communique. Knowing Rickman, he'd recorded these all in one caffeine and amphetamine-fueled push.
I hope it drives you nuts trying to figure out how I got all this intel. Take my advice and don't bother. I'm just smarter than you.
He paused dramatically, letting the seconds tick by.
Freaking out yet, Irene? Want to know what I've got? 'Cause this one's way bigger than Sitting Bull. I mean, who really gives a crap about the Russians? Nothing but a bunch of vodka-swilling losers.
I can't tell you how much I wish I'd been there when Mitch splattered this prick's brains all over the wall, Nash said. Kennedy motioned for silence.
Okay, I guess you've waited long enough, Rickman said. I sent the Iranians a detailed file about how their ambassador to the UK is on your payroll. Names, dates, bank account numbers, even a few nice glossy 8x10s.
He smiled and reached for a remote on his desk.
Have fun.
Is that true? Nash said when the image went black. Kennedy was too stunned to answer. It was absolutely true. Kamal Safavi was their highest-placed Iranian asset, a man well-versed in both his country's fledgling nuclear weapons program and its increasingly severe political power struggles.
What time is it in London, Mike?
He glanced at his watch.
Around midnight.
Kennedy shut down her email and pulled up Safavi's information. She clicked on the text button and sent him an innocuous message that he would recognize as a warning. The contingency plan they'd created was for him and his family to immediately proceed to a safe house where they'd be met by her London station chief. The question was whether Rickman had left time. Would he have seen it as more destructive to let the United States take the man and weather the inevitable Iranian demands for his return, or would he want the Ayatollah to take him and extract everything he knew about the CIA's Iranian operations?
"Where's Mitch?" Kennedy asked.
"We still don't know. He said he had some personal business to deal with and took one of the Gulf Streams we have hangared in Europe."
During this? Kennedy said, letting a rare flash of anger show. You're supposed to keep track of him, Mike. And the agency's planes aren't his private limousines.
Then that's a conversation you should have with him, Irene. Because sometimes he gets a look on his face like he's trying to decide whether it would be more efficient to argue with me or just kill me. As far as I'm concerned, he can do whatever he wants with those planes.
Kennedy's line buzzed, and she picked up. Ken Barrett, her London station chief, was on the other end. He'd been copied on the text she'd sent.
I have people on their way to the safe house, Dr. Kennedy. Do you want me to send anyone to the ambassador's residence?
She didn't answer immediately. Maybe Rickman had timed this to provoke a confrontation between the CIA and the Iranians on London's streets. What she didn't need to do was to create a violent incident in the backyard of America's strongest ally.
Quietly, she said finally. No one does anything but watch unless I give the order. And call Charlie. We need to bring MI6 in on this.
Kennedy hung up and dialed Mitch Rapp's cell number. Until now, she'd left him alone. He rarely disappeared like this, so it stood to reason that what he was doing was important to him. She couldn't wait any longer, though. Wherever he was, his vacation was over. Her stomach tightened with each ring, but finally the line clicked, and Rapp's voice came on.
Yeah. Where are you?
Greece.
Get to London, now.
Chapter 37 Iranian Ambassador's Residence, London, England. Kamal Safavi remained as still as possible, trying not to wake his wife in bed next to him. It was just after midnight, and he'd been lying awake for almost 2 hours. The meeting at the Foreign Office that day had gone predictably badly. MI6 had reports, correct as far as he knew, that Iran had just accepted a delivery of advanced centrifuges from North Korea. Based on his country's history with America, he could understand and sympathize with his master's paranoia regarding the West. The affronts that so consumed them, though, now existed only in history books. They needed to be concerned with the future. They needed to acknowledge that the nuclear program they believed would keep Iran safe was strangling the country's economy. Paralyzed by their misguided fears of an American attack, Iran's government was dooming its population to a death by a thousand cuts. So much foolishness and hate served no purpose. Iran was a rational and stable island in a region that was in the process of tearing itself apart. Only the short-sightedness of their respective politicians prevented the two countries from laying the foundations for an era of cooperation. It was a sentiment that Irene Kennedy shared. She was an eminently reasonable woman who saw the potential of normalizing relations between Tehran and Washington. She understood that Iran's youth had little memory of the Shah or the revolution. They wanted freedom and prosperity. They wanted to occupy a place of respect in the world. There was a static-ridden cry from his nightstand, and he glanced over at the baby monitor as it went silent again. His young daughter was dreaming. But about what? A future of unbounded opportunity? A life in a society that treated her as an equal? Peace and security? Probably not. That was his dream, for her, for all of his people. A moment later, a more urgent sound emanated from the direction of his nightstand. For a few seconds, he was disoriented by the shrillness, unable to remember what it meant. His confusion didn't last long, though, and he snatched up his phone to scan the text on the screen. "Get up!" he said, throwing the covers to the floor and leaping from bed. In the dim glow of the alarm clock, he saw his wife's eyes flutter open. "What is it?" she said, reaching for the lamp by her side of the bed. "Is it Ava? Is she awake?" He grabbed his wife's wrist before she could get to the switch. "Don't turn it on. Just get up and put your robe on, quietly. We're leaving." "Leaving?" she said, alarmed. "What are you talking about?" He had never told her or anyone else about his relationship with Kennedy. He'd thought it was safe, that it was important. Now all he could feel was guilt for what he'd done. His family was in danger. And for what? The idealism that his father had warned him about so many times as a youth? "There is no time to explain," he said in a harsh whisper. "We have to leave, now." Safavi
ran in bare feet to his daughter's room, finding her fast asleep. He lifted her carefully. They had to be silent. Their staff consisted only of a woman who did the cooking and cleaning, and an aging security man who spent most of his time shuttling them around the city. He could afford to wake neither.
"Come on, you're scaring me," his wife said, appearing in the doorway. "What's happening?"
"I'll tell you later," he whispered. "Now we have to get to the car. It's parked right out front."
"But I need to get dressed. I don't even have shoes. We—"
Fortunately, his daughter was still small enough to hold in one arm, and he clamped his free hand around his wife's bicep. The apprehension on her face turned to fear when she felt the force of his grip.
"Come on, you—"
"Silence!"
he whispered as he dragged her toward the stairs. Light from the courtyard filtered through the windows, providing enough illumination to navigate through the furniture arranged in the entryway. Kennedy had warned them in time. They were going to make it. The door was suddenly thrown open with enough force to nearly rip it from its hinges. Safavi's wife screamed as three men ran into their home, shouting in Persian. A forearm hit him in the face, and he held his daughter tight, trying to protect her as he was slammed to the floor.
"No!" he shouted as she was torn away from him.
His wife continued to scream, and he turned his face toward her as his hands were secured behind his back.
"Don't hurt her! She doesn't know anything!"
The man didn't listen, grinding a knee into her back as she was bound with flex cuffs. Their driver appeared at the end of the hallway, but stopped short when he recognized the intruders as being from the embassy's security team. Ava was wailing now, her shrieks echoing eerily through the house. Safavi couldn't breathe with the weight of the man on top of him, but he barely noticed. His wife was sobbing, still having no idea what was happening. He had done this. He was responsible for the terror his wife and child felt. An arm snaked around Safavi's neck, and he felt himself being dragged backward. Their maid appeared and ran instinctively toward the man holding Ava, but was hit in the side of the head with a pistol butt. She collapsed to the floor and went completely still. The arm, cutting off his air, tightened as they exited into a light London rain. Only then did the man holding him speak.
"The Ayatollah is looking forward to seeing you and your family, Kamal."
Chapter 38. London, England. "Pull over." The traffic was almost non-existent on the dark London High Street. To his right, Rapp could see a narrow alleyway swirling with the blue flash of a police cruiser's lights.
"Here?" the cabbie said. "But the address you gave me is another 6 blocks.
Rapp had decided to take a taxi instead of getting someone from the CIA to pick him up at the airstrip. His goal was to slip in and out of Britain with as little fanfare as possible. The Istanbul operation was still bringing down a fair amount of heat, and the EU's intelligence community was starting to suspect him in the death of an Islamic propagandist in Spain 2 months earlier. Entirely true, but proper protocols hadn't been followed, so Kennedy was doing everything she could to shift the blame to the Mossad. Its director owed her, and he seemed amenable to taking responsibility. Rapp retrieved a 100-pound note and held it out for the driver. "I'll walk the rest of the way." The vehicle rolled to a stop near the sidewalk, and Rapp got out without looking back. The dark overcoat he'd found on the plane was enough to keep the rain off, but not enough to hold back the damp cold. He flipped up the collar, partially for warmth, but mostly because London was the most videotaped city in the world. Constant adjustments to the angle of his head kept his face in shadow as he moved across the cobblestones. The uneven surface ended at a street that ran through a posh neighborhood lined with turn-of-the-century buildings. Normally, it would have been quiet at such a late hour. But that night almost every light was on, and he could see people standing at their windows looking down into a crowded street. Rapp turned toward a set of yellow barriers blocking off the area in front of an especially impressive stone building. There were 20 or so civilians talking among themselves near the police line, and he kept his distance, skirting the far edge of the rain-soaked barricade.
"Sir!" a cop shouted, starting toward him with a nightstick in his hand. "This is a restricted area."
"Shut up!"
The man paused for a moment, confused by Rapp's reaction, but then started running at him. He got within 5 yards before one of the two men Rapp was striding toward waved him off.
"Charlie,"
Rapp said, keeping his hands in his jacket pockets as he stopped in front of a man wearing an impeccable Burberry trench coat and bowler. Charles Plimpton
was one of MI6's top men, and he reveled in his role as a British spy. When he'd started out, he'd been vaguely competent, but now political aspirations had set in. Apparently his wife was the second cousin to King Arthur's maid or something. She felt entitled to a higher station in life. "I wish I could say that it's good to see you, Mitch, but whenever you arrive in my country, disaster follows." The other man was Ken Barrett, the CIA's London station chief. He had the more appropriately disheveled look of a man woken in the middle of the night, wrinkled jeans, a hooded parka, and waterproof boots. "What happened?" Rapp said. Barrett was the first to speak. "Irene called me a couple of hours ago and told me Safavi had been compromised. I got in the car and called Charlie. Unfortunately, we were too late."
"Meaning what?" Rapp said.
"Safavi and his family were already gone when we got here."
"For how long?"
"About 15 minutes, according to the cameras."
"Did you track the car? There's no traffic and they're either going to their embassy or an airport."
"Their embassy," Plimpton said.
"So you intercepted? Do we have them?"
Barrett cast his eyes down, and Plimpton answered in his place. "We didn't, Mitch. He's an Iranian diplomat being protected by a car full of Iranian security."
"They're not protecting him, Charlie. They're fucking kidnapping him. They're going to take him back to Tehran, throw him in a hole, and force him to watch while they cut his family apart."
"I'm sympathetic to your viewpoint," Plimpton said in an accent that seemed to get more posh every year. "But this is the CIA's cock-up. We aren't going to create a diplomatic incident trying to set your problem to right."
"Our problem?"
Mitch said, struggling to keep his voice low enough not to be heard by the people rubbernecking near the police perimeter. "You think it's going to help the UK if Iran builds a bomb?"
"I've spoken with the Prime Minister personally, and we've agreed that getting dragged into this isn't in the best interest of Her Majesty's government."
"I don't give a shit what you've agreed,"
Rapp said, grabbing the man by the front of his coat.
"Quit thinking about using your ass to polish a chair in Parliament and do your fucking job. Safavi's put everything on the line for us. Now you're going to just turn your back on him because your wife doesn't feel like she's getting invited to the right parties?"
"Mitch," he heard Barrett caution from behind.
"Shut up, Ken."
"Cops, man." Three uniformed men were edging toward them, obviously not certain what to do. Rapp shoved Plimpton back hard enough that he nearly stumbled over his $400 shoes and grabbed Barrett by the arm.
"Where is Safavi now?"
he said, dragging the London station chief into the shadows at the far end of the square.
"The embassy?"
"Yeah, I have people out front. No activity."
"They can't keep him there forever. He and his family will have to be transported."
"I know what you're thinking, Mitch, but it can't happen. Not here." Rapp locked eyes with Barrett, who took a hesitant step back.
"Easy, man. You know I'd follow you through the gates of hell, but we've lost this round. Even if I wake up the FBI guys, we have no manpower. And the minute we make a move, Charlie's going to have us thrown in jail."
Rapp balled a fist, but managed not to slam it into Barrett's face. He had always been a solid man. Given the chance, he would have pulled out every stop to rescue Safavi, but he wasn't being given that chance. Rickman had nailed down every detail, every contingency, like he always did. Rapp brushed past the man, dialing his phone as he walked across the street. "I understand the situation has deteriorated," Irene Kennedy said when she picked up.
"Safavi's barricaded in the Iranian embassy."
"It's what we feared. Rickman is randomizing his methods to keep us off balance. This time he made sure we wouldn't have time to intervene."
"That piece of shit Charlie Plimpton's not going to let us make a move as long as Safavi's on British soil. The Iranians are going to have to get him back to Tehran, though it's possible that we could intercept the plane."
"I've talked to the President and he says no. He's been working to thaw the relationship between the U.S. and Iran since he took office, and this is a big enough setback as it is. Interfering with their flight would put us on a war footing."
"So I'm just supposed to do nothing so we can make sure no one's political career gets bruised?"
"I'm sorry, Mitch. There's nothing I can do."
"I don't want to hear that, Irene. Rick's just getting warmed up. He's going to bleed us until there's nothing left."
"I might have some good news on that front. Can you get to Rome?"
"Why?"
"Mike's already on the way. He can brief you."
"I don't like it, Irene. Istanbul, London, now Rome. Rick's leading us around on a leash. We can't afford to keep reacting. We need to get ahead of this."
"You ask me to trust you. Now I'm asking you to trust me." He glanced upward as the rain started coming down harder.
Italy.
I'll let Mike know you're on your way. Oh, and Mitch?
What?
Let him do the talking, okay?
Chapter 39. Islamabad, Pakistan.
But, sir, I—
Shut up and listen, Saad Chutani shouted.
Taj cradled the phone handset between his ear and shoulder as Pakistan's president continued his rant. Of course, it was necessary to provide the occasional frightened grunt or affirmation to indicate his rapt attention, but in reality, he was scrolling through his email.
I want this journalistic hack silenced, do you understand? I will not have distortions and lies spread by our newspapers.
4 days ago, the Pakistani Taliban had attacked a girls' school that Chutani heavily supported. In fact, he had personally attended its opening, hailing it as the foundation of a new Pakistan. There had even been champagne and an absurd Western-style ribbon-cutting. Now it was a burned-out husk, surrounded by the bullet-riddled bodies of young girls who should have been at home under the supervision of their fathers and brothers.
"Answer me, Ahmed!"
Taj frowned. He'd assumed the question was rhetorical, and the fool would continue to shout endlessly while saying nothing of consequence. A gift all politicians had, but that this one excelled at in particular.
"Sir, there was simply no question that the press was going to cover this incident. I have the article you're concerned about in front of me, and while it lays out the facts, I don't find it disrespectful to you or your administration. It—"
"Not disrespectful? Can you read, Ahmed? It makes me look powerless. How could this have even happened? It's your job, and the job of the S-Wing, to control these events."
It was an interesting choice of words. Not prevent, but control. And indeed, Taj did. He had personally planned and authorized the attack. It was all part of the delicate balance he was attempting to strike. While Chutani's assassination, ostensibly by the Americans, needed to be an event that stoked Pakistan's nationalism, the dead president couldn't be too popular. He needed to be portrayed as a good man who wasn't equal to the task. The people had to understand that Pakistan needed a stronger leader, someone who could achieve the order that the Democrats had so miserably failed to deliver.
"The death of Akhtar Durrani created a period of blindness, Mr. President. I assure you that his successor has now fully transitioned into his position. Making that transition completely seamless, though, was impossible, and the Taliban knew it. They took advantage of the brief period of weakness."
"Excuses!"
"I'm sorry," Taj said, conjuring a hint of fearfulness.
"I'm doing the best—"
"We have to deal with the reporter, Ahmed, now. There's nothing we can do about your incompetence in letting the attack succeed, but we can certainly shape the aftermath."
"The article has already been published, sir. There's no way to—"
"It's emboldening the other media outlets," Chutani shouted. "In the last 2 days, there have been 2 articles critical of my involvement with the American drone attacks, and a newscaster has come out publicly against secular education. Without consequences, there is no way to know what they'll say next."
Chutani wanted to impress the West with the free press just so long as it was entirely supportive of his administration. And when it wasn't, he called the man he'd hired for his weakness, expecting him to suddenly transform into an assassin.
"What kind of consequences are you talking about, sir?"
"We don't need a press like the Americans have, Ahmed. One that spews lies and distortions 24 hours a day in search of profits. Pakistan needs fair and patriotic media outlets dedicated to moving the country forward. This recent activity sets a dangerous precedent."
Taj smiled. Of course, the politician wouldn't give a specific order. He had to have deniability. Should the coercion of Pakistan's newspeople become public, he would need Taj and the ISI as a scapegoat.
"Private media is dependent on advertising dollars, Mr. President. I'll have my people speak to the companies that support these outlets and ask them whether it's in their best interest to encourage this kind of journalism."
There was a long, disappointed silence. Chutani undoubtedly wanted the man dead, and Taj completely understood.
After he had closed his fist around Pakistan, a man like this would watch his entire family die before being exterminated like the animal he was. However, now wasn't the time to be pulled into something this controversial. He would need the Americans' unwitting support during his rise to power, and the assassination of a journalist could jeopardize that support.
"I assure you this will be quite effective," Taj continued. "No media company can afford to be painted as unpatriotic, and a large number of their advertisers have significant ownership by the Army and ISI. They'll publish no more articles critical of you, and if we proceed carefully, I think we can coerce a retraction, or at least a clarification that highlights the difficulties of stamping out terrorism and provides examples of how effective your administration has been thus far."
"If this is your recommendation, I will accept it," Chutani said, still unwilling to make demands that could be traced back to him. "But I expect results, Amit."
There was a knock on his office door, and a moment later, Kabir Gadai entered.
"I think you'll be quite satisfied," Taj said, watching his assistant approach. "We should be able to resolve the situation without undue risk to you or your government."
"Tomorrow morning, Amit. I want a briefing on your plan's specifics tomorrow morning."
"I'll have my people schedule a meeting."
The line went dead, and Taj hung up the phone.
"Our president can be quite the hysterical woman."
Gadai smiled and took a seat.
"What news do you have for me, Kabir? Have you determined what was in the Rickman file that we released?"
"I believe I have, sir."
He held out a manila envelope containing a number of 8x10 photographs, and Taj began flipping through them. He recognized the city as London, and two of the men behind the police barricade as being from MI6 and the CIA. But other than that, the images meant little to him. "Those are stills from security cameras installed near the Iranian ambassador's residence. Our resources say that he and his family were taken by Iranian security in the middle of the night. They're being recalled to Tehran."
"Was a threat made against him? This might have been done for his own protection."
"That's what we thought at first, too."
"What changed your mind?"
"Do you see the man in the black coat? The one whose face is always turned away from the camera? We believe that's Mitch Rapp."
Taj spread out the photos in front of him and studied the man in question. It was difficult to determine detail, but in a strange way, that's what made the images stand out. In the middle of London, during a well-lit police operation, there wasn't a single definitive photo. Taj leaned back in his chair and met his assistant's gaze.
"So, you're saying that Kamal Safavi was on the CIA's payroll?"
"It seems likely. Since this occurred, there's been a huge increase in diplomatic traffic between Iran and the United States, including a reported personal conversation between the Ayatollah and President Alexander. It's the first direct communication between the two men that we're aware of."
Taj felt the perspiration break across his forehead. If he'd had an asset this highly placed, only one or two of his most trusted people would have known. Kennedy operated no differently. If Rickman had access to this level of intelligence, what else could be hidden in his files? What did he know about the Israelis? About America's politicians and allies? Indeed, what did he know about Pakistan?
"It's a massive blow to the U.S., Gadai said, sounding typically prideful. "The thawing of relations between Iran and America was one of the cornerstones of Alexander's Middle East strategy. He hoped to build a Shiite bulwark against the expansion of Sunni militias."
"Don't be too pleased with yourself, Kabir. The loss of Safavi has harmed America. But if we'd had access to this information instead of being forced to release it, we would have had the tools to turn one of the CIA's highest-placed assets. He was a well-liked moderate with political aspirations. Who knows how useful he could have been in keeping the Iranians in their place? This wasn't a victory. It was an opportunity missed. Don't ever forget that."
"Yes, sir," Gadai said, averting his eyes appropriately.
Taj needed to keep the young man's arrogance in check, and highlighting the negative side of the situation was a good way of doing it. Having said that, it was admittedly difficult not to revel in this particular failure. A partnership between Iran and America would significantly extend the West's influence in the Middle East. It was a natural alliance that had been made impossible by a powerful but largely empty animosity between the two countries. Now the flames of that fire would once again burn bright.
The question I'm interested in, Kabir, is whether the file release got us any closer to finding the man who can decrypt the files.
Yes, absolutely, Gadai said, recovering quickly from his reprimand. My people were able to trace it even farther than they originally thought. Perhaps as few as 2 more releases will lead us to his location.
And the next one is scheduled for when?
Tomorrow. Taj nodded thoughtfully. It was difficult not to speculate what that dispatch contained. What damage it would do to the country that believed it had the right to rule the world.
Unfortunately, we have no choice. You have my authorization.
Chapter 40. Rome, Italy. The sun was up by the time Mitch Rapp's Gulfstream landed at the private airport in Rome. It had barely rolled to a stop when a black BMW with heavily tinted windows pulled alongside. Rapp jumped out of the plane without lowering the stairs and walked briskly across the runway. Inside the car, Mike Nash leaned over the seats and threw one of the back doors open. Rapp slid inside, and a moment later they were accelerating toward the highway. "Your suit and tie are in the garment bag," Nash said. "There's a passport in the breast pocket with the name Mitch Cruz. The entry stamps have you arriving last night. You were on a Turkish Airlines flight out of Dulles." Typically thorough, but ironically, Rapp wasn't the problem on that particular day. His operations on Italian soil had all gone relatively smoothly. Nash, on the other hand, had been betrayed during a rendition in Sicily a few years back, and was now a wanted man in Italy. This little excursion must have been important if Kennedy was willing to risk sending him to Rome. "Who are you?" Rapp asked, unzipping the garment bag. "Michael Blake, a.k.a. a guy who's very anxious to finish this little errand and get out of here." Rapp started stripping off his clothes as they merged into traffic. The suit was his, one of the few he kept in a locker at Langley. So was the Glock 19 and the custom shoulder holster that contained it. A silencer hung from the side opposite the weapon, as did a spare magazine. Hopefully, neither would be necessary. The heat coming down on the CIA from enemies and allies alike was starting to take its toll on ops all over the globe. "Where are we going?" "To see an attorney. Our luck might finally be changing. We had Daisy Chain searching for mentions of law firms. You got the NSA involved?" Rapp didn't trust those tech freaks. He spent more time worrying about them monitoring his communications than he did about foreign intelligence agencies. "No choice, Mitch. We just don't have that kind of computer firepower." London had already put him in a dark mood, and the involvement of Fort Meade wasn't making it any better. "We'll talk about that later," Rapp said, putting the partially buttoned dress shirt over his head. "What did they come up with?" "More stuff than I want to remember. All complete crap, until they turned up an obituary from an Italian newspaper. A woman named Isabella Accorso was killed in a car accident along with her daughter." "How is this interesting to me?" "Well, first, she worked at a large law firm, managing trusts and payments to clients. She's the person who'd administer the kind of scenario we think Rick set up. We figured he'd check in with someone like her on a given schedule, and if he didn't, she'd start sending the files he gave her."
"That's it?" Rapp said.
"No. The crash was a head-on with a truck that crossed into her lane. The driver was an undocumented Pakistani immigrant."
"Thin."
"It gets better. Irene strong-armed the Italians into giving us the records from the law firm's internet service provider. We found heavily encrypted files going out the day before the Rickman stuff hit the streets."
"Is he alive?"
"Who?"
"The Pakistani driver."
"Yeah.
Can we get to him?"
"Well, he's in an unguarded hospital room, if that's what you mean."
"I take it that's not as good as it sounds."
"He apparently wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and the part of his brain you'd want to communicate with is still on the inside of the windshield. So we're on our way to talk to the managing partner of Accorso's firm."
Rapp finished dressing and did the best he could to smooth his unruly hair. The reflection in the side window suggested that despite the month's salary he'd spent on the suit, it didn't have the power to make him look respectable. His grooming was aimed more at being able to walk around Kabul unnoticed than blending into American boardrooms. He sat back and watched the ancient buildings pass by. Italy had always felt like a second home to him. He'd spent many happy, if infuriating, months living there with a fashion designer who had a way with ice picks. Probably not the right woman for him, but also not entirely the wrong one. She understood and accepted the life he'd chosen, neither judging him nor worrying every time he didn't make it home for dinner. On the other hand, he'd never been able to sleep well lying next to her. There was no question that there was a price at which she'd turn that ice pick on him. A high price, to be sure, but he'd still found himself habitually searching the bed for hidden weapons while they were having sex. He'd resigned himself to the fact that another Anna Riley would never come along. Trying to find a replica of her would only make him and the poor woman he ended up with miserable. Anna had been everything to him, but as time went on, he could start to see the flaws in their relationship. She'd come to terms with what he did, but had never become comfortable with it. He could see now that the dissonance had been slowly driving her insane. Anna believed strongly that people were fundamentally good, and that violence inevitably led to disaster. He developed a somewhat different philosophy. It was time to change his life before it was too late. Shaking off the habits he'd picked up from Hurley was a good start, but there was going to be a lot more to it than that. Selling the burned husk of his and Anna's home would have to finally happen. And getting out of the dank apartment he'd landed in wouldn't hurt either. Most of all, though, he needed to figure out how he could be in a relationship that didn't end with an ice pick in the ear or his partner having a nervous breakdown. For now, though, he had to shove all that into a dark corner of his mind. If he didn't stop Rickman, his elaborate plans for self-improvement wouldn't be necessary. More than likely, he'd end up the subject of the very public witch hunt led by the politicians who had spent the last 2 decades demanding his protection. Rapp didn't realize he'd dozed off until the BMW glided to a stop in front of a building with a series of flags hanging over the entrance. He stepped out, looking up at the 6-story glass structure. "Irene says I'm supposed to take the lead," Nash said. "We're not dangling anyone out of windows today." "They don't open." Nash wasn't sure whether that was meant as a joke, and flashed a nervous smile before starting toward the lobby. Rapp dragged his feet behind. He hated lawyers, and was dreading the meeting. If Kennedy really didn't want him to do anything, why was he here? Clearly she expected results, and wasn't certain that Nash's honey tongue was enough to get them. There was no security beyond a friendly woman who used her broken English to give them directions. Nash looked a little apprehensive as they rode the elevator to the top floor, an emotion the former Marine never displayed when getting shot at or blown up. He was still transitioning into his new job and wasn't yet comfortable with his role as management. Also, the knowledge that Rapp and Kennedy were watching his every move wasn't doing much to calm his nerves. 2 men were already waiting for them in a conference room nestled in a quiet corner of the executive floor. Nash strode in with an easy smile. "Mike Blake," he said, shaking hands with the older of the 2 men. "It's good to finally meet you, Mr. Cipriani." "Please call me Marcello," the man said with a light accent. "May I present my attorney, Dante Necchi?" Nash's smile broadened, while Rapp's own expression darkened. The lawyer they'd come to see had a lawyer. Outstanding. "Good to meet you, Dante," he motioned behind him. "This is my colleague, Mitch Cruz." Rapp sat in an empty chair and stared straight ahead, unwilling to shake hands with either man. He just wanted to get what they were here to get and head back to the plane. Maybe after a quick stop for a plate of carbonara. He hadn't eaten anything for almost 12 hours.
"What is Mr. Cruz's role in this meeting?" Necchi said, looking a bit bemused. "To intimidate us?"
"Don't be ridiculous," Nash said. "He's part of our legal team." Neither man seemed convinced, but they let it go. Necchi laid a cell phone on the table.
"I assume you won't object to this meeting being recorded?"
Nash continued his valiant effort to be disarming. Not at all. Now we have...
And by we, you're referring to America's Central Intelligence Agency?
I'm referring to the U.S. government in general. Now, may I continue?
By all means.
We have reason to believe that classified information stolen from us has been given to your firm. Both men looked a bit startled, and Nash raised his hand before that surprise could turn to indignation. Unknown to you, of course. We are not suggesting any impropriety on your part. It would be in the form of a series of encrypted files that you would be asked to release if you aren't contacted by your client on a given schedule. Rapp kept his gaze locked on the managing partner, who in turn kept his on Nash, so as to avoid eye contact.
"We have many clients who have many schedules for many things," Necky said. "All completely legal.
Again, I'm aware of your firm's sterling reputation and that you would have no way of knowing what's in these files.
I assume that you're not just here to tell us this. That you want something from my client?
In the past weeks, your firm has been responsible for releasing information that's compromised our national security and gotten a number of people killed. For obvious reasons, we'd like to see that stopped.
And how would you know what files this firm has released?
I don't think that's important right now.
Does this have anything to do with the internet video of your Joe Rickman being tortured?
I don't think that's relevant to our discussion either.
I, however, believe it is. And I find it odd that a group of jihadists would use a law firm to administer a series of schedules and triggers. Why wouldn't they just release the information into the public domain?
Hard to say.
Do you understand what you're asking, Mr. Blake? I presume your legal counsel, Mr. Cruz, does. You're asking us to completely ignore our legal obligations in regard to this matter. In light of that, your equivocations are rather insulting.
Rapp took a deep breath and let it out slowly. He was willing, actually anxious, to let Nash handle this. But there was a limit to how long he was going to sit there and listen to this bullshit. If that's the case, Dante, I apologize. I certainly didn't intend to give offense.
I have to wonder, Necky said, warming up to the subject. Since I think we all agree that jihadists hiring this firm is absurd, who might have? Is it possible that Rickman himself is responsible? Perhaps he was afraid he was being targeted by your organization and was using the threat of releasing these secrets to protect himself.
That's an interesting piece of speculation, but we seem to be ranging pretty far from the subject, don't you think?
Is Mr. Rickman dead?
I don't know Rickman's status. Necky clearly wasn't buying that.
The CIA may be all-powerful in the United States, Mr. Blake, but not in Italy. We have laws.
Rapp couldn't help laughing out loud, and everyone turned toward him.
I'm sorry, he said. I was just thinking about the scientists you put in jail for not predicting an earthquake and the fact that your former prime minister spent most of his time screwing underage hookers. But by all means, tell us more about the integrity of your legal system. This meeting's finally starting to get entertaining.
Necky lost his train of thought for a moment, but recovered quickly.
For all we know, your organization murdered Mr. Rickman because he was trying to expose your illegal activities.
Rapp leaned back in his chair, and when he did, Cipriani fixated on the bulge in the side of his jacket.
Is this man armed? He said, alarmed.
Don't be ridiculous, Nash said, still trying to remain civil. It's just bad tailoring.
This meeting is over, Necky said, standing. If you want to speak to us further, you can make a request through the appropriate political channels.
Isabella Accorsa was handling the files, wasn't she? Nash said. Cipriani had started to stand, but at the mention of her name sank back into a seat.
Why do you say that?
Because she's dead.
It was a traffic accident.
Nash shook his head. Since you've taken your shot at speculation, let me have a turn. Someone contacted Accorsa and demanded that she give him copies of those files. She was scared, so she did it. Then when this person got what he wanted, he had her killed.
One of the reasons you're fighting us is because you don't want to admit that you've lost those files. Right now, you've got your tech people searching for them in your backups, but they're coming up empty.
That's absurd, Nakey said. Isabella and her daughter died in a car accident. We are not as gullible as the American people, Mr. Blake. You can't come in here and wave an American flag expecting us to roll over. Using the deaths of these two women to further the CIA's agenda is outrageous. More than that, it's disgusting.
Rapp had given Nash every opportunity to resolve this, and he was getting nowhere. These idiots had let the Rickman files fall into the hands of one of America's enemies. And if he had to listen to another 10 seconds of their fake indignation, someone was going to get pistol-whipped.
Enough, Rapp said, slamming his palm down on the table. People are already dead because of your firm, including one of your employees and her daughter. Now you're going to be good citizens and give us every scrap of information you have on this.
Are you? Nicky stammered. Are you threatening us?
What threat? Nash said, trying to regain control of the meeting.
I didn't hear a threat.
In that case, I apologize for not being clear, Rapp said, picking up Nicky's phone and enunciating clearly into it. If one more of our people is harmed because of this firm's lack of cooperation, I'm going to pay Mr. Cipriani here a visit. After that, you can file as many diplomatic protests and lawsuits as you want. It's not going to do him a whole lot of good.
The room got very quiet as Nicky searched for some piece of legalese that would have any meaning at all, and Nash tried to figure out a way to spin Rapp's words into something benign. Surprisingly, it was Cipriani who broke the silence.
Our firm certainly wouldn't want to see harm come to the courageous men and women who protect our countries from terrorism.
Marcello, Nicky cautioned, you have a responsibility, and I take those responsibilities very seriously, Dante, but we're being told that Isabella was murdered because of our involvement with those files. This situation has clearly escalated beyond something our firm can handle and has become a matter for the intelligence community.
You've made the right decision, Marcello, Nash said. Your cooperation is going to save lives. Now, can I assume that I was right when I said that you're looking into this?
Yes, Cipriani responded, his eyes flicking briefly toward Rapp. After Isabella's death, we immediately did an audit of her responsibilities in order to make certain our clients received the uninterrupted service they've come to expect from us. The files from one of those clients had been wiped from our system.
The backups as well?
Yes. I'm told they're completely unrecoverable.
Bull,
Rapp said.
Cipriani's voice rose a bit in pitch.
I swear that I'm telling you the truth.
Of course you are, Nash said, delivering a subtle kick to Rapp's leg beneath the table. But we may have capabilities that you don't. In fact, we've got a very nice young man named Marcus, who specializes in resolving these kinds of problems. Can I assume you'd be willing to give him access to your system?
Cipriani chewed his lip for a moment before answering.
Of course.
Thank you, Marcello. That's very helpful. Now, is there any other information you can give us?
Cipriani nodded.
The client is completely anonymous, but we have a hard copy of his instructions. They include various scenarios and schedules for file release.
I'd love to have the original of that as well as your assurance that no copies exist.
I'll arrange it.
That was apparently more than Nicky could bear.
Marcello, this is malpractice. You can't—
Shut up, Dante,
Cipriani said before Rapp had to.
I don't think I need you anymore. Why don't you go back to your office?
But now, Dante.
He reached for his phone, but Rapp beat him to it and smashed it against the table.
I don't think it benefits either party to have a recording of this conversation, Nash said as Rapp stood and headed for the door. He pulled out his wallet and tossed a few €100 notes on the table to cover the damage.
Now, if you could get us that original, it looks like we're leaving.
Chapter 41 CIA Headquarters, Langley, Virginia, USA.
Is Mitch all right? Marcus Dumont said. He looks dead.
Not yet,
Rapp said from his position lying on the couch in Irene Kennedy's office. He didn't bother to open his eyes when the young hacker walked in.
more than 48 hours without sleep, had made them feel like they were full of sand.
"You sure?" Dumont said. "You kind of smell like it."
Also, more than 48 hours without a shower, he was reminded.
"What did you find?" Kennedy said, as Rapp pushed himself into a sitting position.
She was at her desk with Mike Nash in one of the facing chairs. He was fresh as a daisy in neatly pressed khakis and a golf shirt. No matter what the circumstances, Nash always looked like the former Eagle Scout he was.
"Not much," Dumont admitted. "The computers were wiped clean."
"Not what we wanted to hear," Rapp said. "Are you sure?"
"Mitch, please, do I tell you how to shoot people?"
Rapp didn't react other than to frown imperceptibly. In his current mood, anyone else ribbing him would have found themselves with their face shoved through a wall. He had a soft spot for this kid, though. Dumont had always reminded Rapp of his younger brother Stephen, but with an afro.
"Could they be holding out on us?" Nash said. "Dante Necky didn't look happy about handing us the keys to their kingdom."
Dumont shook his head. "The files were overwritten the day Isabella Accorso died. They have a system in place.